If we may move directly to the meeting of the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee, are there any additions, corrections, or modifications of the agenda? Please note that Cinderbed Road has been added, and there are new papers associated with a 2011 budget discussion. If not, the agenda is approved without objection. Minutes, are there additions or corrections to the minutes? Without objection, those are also approved. Action items, our first action item is a reimbursable project for the City of Alexandria, the Eisenhower Station Entrance Addition, and improvements to bus bay and parking at King Street. And Mr. Kubicek, are you making this presentation?
Do you need a motion, or do you want to see the presentation?
Does everybody want to see this presentation, or do we want to just move?
Let's move.
Move the item.
And sir, Mr. Chairman.
If I could, I would like to note one error in the presentation.
Please.
The monetary amount on page one that's listed at 20.5, what's listed in the meet is actually correct at 35.941. And then the monetary amount noted here at 26.5, the correct monetary amount in the meet is correct at 41.941.
Question.
Mr. Zimmerman.
But the language in the draft resolution is correct?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to point out there was a difference between the presentation and the meeting.
I move that the project be recommended for approval before.
Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. I do have a question just for clarification. The board action information summary and the resolution are either not clear or conflicting as to whether for Eisenhower Avenue, we are approving construction, or we're approving a study. Or the amount of money. Amount of money is only for a study. But are we approving a bigger project?
No, we're just approving the. We're approving the project, the establishment of the project, and an initial budget to get us through the planning phase.
So, are we approving a construction project at this point, or do we want to see the results of the study before we move forward to the second stage?
We have to come back to the board with the results of that study before we move on. So no construction project at this time.
Could we clarify then at this point that what we are doing is approving just the study portion?
Okay.
And then you'll come back and get the rest of the project at a later date. The other thing is there is in the presentation a notation about operating impacts, and in the official documentation there's nothing about operating impacts. Clearly, if we do open another entrance, particularly right now we're talking about closing entrances, there are some operating impacts. Before this comes to the board, would we have those documented and included as part of the official materials that come to the board?
Put that in the funding impact section.
Okay, and if that's okay with both the mover and the seconder? Okay. We're ready for a vote. Are there any other comments on this one? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. We move on to amend the agreement between MWAA and Metro to provide Dulles II preliminary engineering. And Mr. Kubicek again.
Okay, this is basically beginning to talk about phase two. This is basically initiated as $3.5 million if it will be reimbursable. As you know, right now we're underneath the process with phase one with our work in construction and working with MWA. And this presentation is just solely focused on the preliminary engineering phase of phase two. We would have to return back to the board for approval for a budget and a second agreement for the design build portion of phase two. This is just to initiate the initial PE. Slide, please. Again, just to reiterate that this is about phase two of the Metro Rail extension, and again, 3.5. And that's all that I have on my presentation, unless there's any other further questions.
Questions or comments? Ms. Hutchins.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move approval of the resolution.
It is moved and seconded. Ms. Hutchins and Mr. McKay. Questions and comments? I have a question. Since it appears that you have, in fact, already negotiated this agreement, is that right?
Yes.
Which we haven't seen. It would be interesting to know, since this is a very critical function, we are now going to be involved in reviewing essentially the work that goes on in preliminary engineering, is that right?
Yes, sir.
What rights and responsibilities do we have if we disagree with decisions that are being made by the airport's authority during this construction process or engineering process?
The agreement has a disputes clause escalating up to the executives of both organizations, which would be Mr. Cato, Mr. Bennett from the airport's authority. If the lower-level staff cannot resolve any disputes that come up between the two entities.
So what starts out happening is that if our people do, and I assume we're putting enough people with $3.5 million on this so that we can, in fact, look at it very, very carefully.
Yes.
If our people look at some of these designs and say, no, we don't agree, this does not meet our standards, which we have provided to them, we then can stop what's going on, and it goes through this process of determining what's appropriate until it gets up to the two general managers.
Correct. They don't necessarily stop with advancing the preliminary engineering, but it does get advanced, and if it's critical enough, it'll get advanced very quickly.
And what happens if the two general managers don't agree?
Presume that they would, but in one way or another.
If not, then I need to bring that to the board have a discussion. And I would assume in talking to Jim Bennett that his board would also get involved in that. So the two policy boards would then have a process to resolve the issue. If that has not happened, but in our discussion, should that happen, that's where it would go next.
And so are we now taking responsibility to assure that what is going to be at least designed at this stage and later on built meets appropriate operating standards and construction standards for Metro? Is that what we're doing?
Yes, sir.
I just want to make sure that that's really clear, that that's, we're taking a responsibility on here. It's not just we're going to be looking over somebody's shoulder. We're taking on the responsibility for making sure that the decisions that are made are reflected in what eventually gets built. Okay?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
First, Ms. Hutchins.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your drawing out that explanation, because as you will note in the presentation, phase one, preliminary engineering has gone forward and construction has begun, and that in doing so, that is exactly the process that has been followed there, and the agreement, I think, is one that reflects the same type of agreement that we indeed are accepting the system upon completion, and therefore must between the two parties meet the requirements that we have. And
thank you, Ms. Hudgens. Mr. Lenton.
Just further, I mean, I'm just supporting what was just recently stated. I thought that was our understanding from in phase one as well, that you know, we had been monitoring preliminary engineering, even at that phase, to make sure that they met our standards, and that's what we were operating under. And this is basically just a continuation of that.
I just want to make sure that we are publicly noting that we are taking responsibility and we do have some authority in this process, and that that will then be reflected when there's a completed project that we can, in fact, take over and operate effectively.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, thus far in phase one, there have been, there's always disputes, particularly in a project of this size. Thus far, there have only been two issues that have not been able to been resolved at my level. One of those was resolved by Mr. Couch before he left, and the second one was recently by Mr. Kubitschek. So nothing has reached, from a dispute standpoint, not being able to be resolved by at least one level above me. So the process is working.
Thank you very much. Are we ready for a vote, or are there additional comments? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. That one is unanimously approved. Bring us to the Cinderbed Road agreements. I will note that this is blue. There are changes to the documents that we've been given. Mr. Kubitschek.
Yes, sir. Basically, what we're asking here for is to allow the general manager to sign a master development agreement And also, main point is to transfer $2 million from the Arlington Bus Garage sale to the Cinder Bed Road project. Note, item three has been struck. This basically kind of gives a timeline of this project that has been proceeding forward and some historical background. Also notes the current location to the new proposed site. On this right in here, our most recent activity is, you know, we're trying to provide one entity to acquire the land, services necessary to gain, you know, Fairfax County special exemptions, assist in finalizing the purchase of the land, and basically we're also focused on the design and the construction of for the facility. Next slide, please. The recommendation here is to permit the general manager to sign a master development agreement in January 2010. And our second recommendation is so that way we can to transfer the $2 million from the Arlington Bus Garage sale to the Cinder Bed Road. My understanding, this was a process that was similar done for West Off. Okay. And that is it.
Okay, and the change that was made was to delete the general manager
yes.
authority to sign a design build agreement and just limit it to the master agreement.
And that was recommendations from council.
Okay. Do we have questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval.
I have a motion and a second. Mr. Zimmerman seconding. Any other comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Excuse me. This one is also unanimously approved. We move on to the information items. Ms. Kissel, start us out on the 2011 budget.
This presentation is actually in response to a resolution that was passed by the board to report on a proposed fare policy when a fare policy was enacted a few years ago. It also was is a report to report back to the board on our service guarantee program. This is in the initial stages, so this is information only, not an action item. In order to go through the presentation, I have Matt Brown, who is our managing director for budget, who you know. With him, actually, is Vicki Ellis, who is also our revenue forecaster, and that can take you through some of the questions. We also have with us Jay Evans, who is our consultant on our Cambridge model, which is a model that I had referenced in the past, which helps us develop some of the forecast on ridership. So he'll be here to address any questions that you have regarding that. And we also have Tom Harrington here to talk to us a little bit about the planning side of that. So with that opening, I'm going to kick this off over to Matt Brown to go through the presentation.
Thank you, Mrs. Kissel. The next slide states the resolution is passed by the board. As Ms. Kissel indicated, this is to give you an update of where we are in our work with regard to this policy, to this this resolution. The purpose is to give you an update on our progress. The information that we provide today, I hope, will provide input on our fare policies and the changes that we're considering as we work through the FY11 budget process. I anticipate we will complete our work on what we've been instructed to do here this spring as we consider our FY11 budget, and as we continue to assess our current ridership and revenue situation, and as the new fare changes that will be proposed in the budget are considered by this board. As you all know, ridership varies by time of day. It varies by time of the year. We know that this ridership is generally we have less ridership in the winter than we do in the summer months when tourists use our season. So certain things that we do know about our riders. Also want to point out that Metro charges regular fares during the peak and shoulder periods and discounted fares at other times to encourage system use when there's extra capacity. We meet our customer demand by providing increased capacity during peak periods and longer trains and more frequent service. So that's how we meet our peak demands There's been a lot of discussion lately. There was even a Washington Post article recently about charging more when people are willing to pay. There are some instances when Metro does charge for what I would term premium services. That includes express bus service. It includes the service that we provide to the airports, to BWI and Dulles airports. And at reserve parking, we charge a premium for those who wish to reserve spaces at our Metro lots. We also charge a premium at two of our lots during baseball games. I believe it's about $20 that we charge for parking at those stations. There are other items, in addition to the AM and the PM and the time of the year, that affect our ridership. These are, these are factors that go into the Cambridge Systematics model. We've been working with Cambridge to project our ridership, and then that helps us with our revenue. And Jay, if I could turn it over to you to talk through.
Okay, thank you. We did develop several econometric models for Metro to predict ridership in short-term basis, and we tested a number of variables. In terms of the variables that we ended up with in some of the final models, they included variables dealing with tourism, demographics, Metro Rail fares. We did test Metro bus fares in models. Parking availabilities among the tested variables. Revenue hours of service was tested. Special factors such as gas prices, severe weather events, and special events that are non-recurring, such as presidential inaugurations. These are things that we found in these models to be indicators of ridership levels. And in terms of the general accepted models, we have the key variables being DC employment or DC population, and hotels, rooms sold, and Smithsonian visitation as major variables affecting the short-term ridership forecasts.
These are the methodology that is used by Cambridge is similar to what we use when we develop our ridership models, and we've been comparing notes actually over the last month or so. We came to the board earlier this month with a projected revenue shortfall of about $38 million. We developed those ridership numbers in-house. We've compared those to what Cambridge has looked at, and we're within percentage points of agreeing on the ridership. So I think that our methodology and actually our results have been consistent. We've also looked at how Cambridge numbers compare to what we've projected for the FY11 budget. As you'll recall, in a presentation that we gave to the board in December, we've assumed about a 2% ridership growth on rail and about 1.5% on bus. Right now, the Cambridge model projects that ridership growth will actually be a little bit higher than we've initially projected. So we're continuing to work through this. I think that the board will continue to be updated as we move through the FY11 budget process. But I think this does provide some confirmation that the work that we're doing in-house is appropriate. And again, a forecast is a forecast. But I think that the work that we're doing in-house has integrity and is our best estimate of what is happening with ridership, both in the current fiscal year, but also in FY11 as we consider the FY11 budget. I would note that Mr. Evans is on a short time period, and he does need to leave the building at noon. If you have any questions about the information that appears on this slide or the factors that Cambridge considers in their model, I would invite you to ask those questions now so that while Mr. Evans is available.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Well, I wonder if this relates to the question I asked last week in the board meeting about the forecast for ridership on the rail system relative to that on the bus system for the remainder of this year. That was done using this model?
No, it wasn't directly made using this model, but the results that we have, the work that Cambridge does, and it informs the model, the work that we do in-house.
Okay, well, if you will recall, my question concerned the difference between the forecast for the remainder of the year, bus ridership and rail ridership, and whereas the bus ridership fall was pretty much fixed, the rail ridership fall was essentially shown to moderate.
Correct.
Now.
We've seen that in our year-to-date trends. The Cambridge model projects annual ridership. The model that we use does a monthly projection. If you look at the annual numbers for both what we have projected and what we presented to the board last week, and what Cambridge has done, the annual numbers are within, the rail number is within 1.3% of what was projected by Cambridge, and the bus number is 3.1% different than what we had projected with our step-down model. So I think that they are different methodologies, looking at the same variables. Cambridge has projected an annual number. We've projected using our monthly ridership data, and we met, I think, and I'll ask Mr. Evans to confirm that, but we met in the middle. I mean, the ridership that we've projected is really right on to what the annual numbers for Cambridge has projected.
The only reason I'm asking, because it was striking to me that the forecast on which the current estimate of this gap, the problem we have, is based, mm-hmm. assumes that rail ridership will effectively recover much more than will bus ridership. And I was wondering why that would be. And we did get a written response that we got last night as part of some other answers, which is one of the longest responses, maybe the longest response that we've got. It does not answer the question at all. But starts out by noticing that part of the difference between the forecast is the difference in the total budget amounts and talks about the magnitudes. However, I was asking about percentage change, not the dollar change.
Okay.
I was asking why it is we think, do we have good reason to believe that, in fact, rail ridership will recover in the second half of this year to a degree bus ridership will not. If there's a reason to believe that, okay, but that's an interesting difference in the numbers. And so is there something in the model or in the factors that enter into it that say, yeah, we think this will happen for such and such reason? I'm looking at the page here that, particularly the last statement there, which shows that essentially, the rail ridership in the weekday is highly correlated to D.C. employment and hotel rooms sold. That's not terribly surprising. While weekday and weekend bus, basically all bus, is about D.C. population, well, most of the bus service is in D.C., so I understand that. And weekend rail ridership, because there's not as much riding on the rail in the suburbs on the weekend. Okay. But does any of that add up to a reason for a greater recovery on the rail side than on the bus side in ridership?
I think I'd make 2 points, and if necessary, we can follow up with additional information. The ridership decreases that we've seen on rail are much less than in bus. Year-over-year decreases in rail have been 3.5% on rail, and on bus, it's, the number I have is, I have the wrong table here, but the declines have been more dramatic on bus.
Yes.
On rail, there are two things that we've seen. We anticipate that employment will... The other thing that we've seen on rail, if I may, is that the decreases are lessening. Every month we see a smaller variance against our budget.
That was pointed out last week, and I said, okay, so that's where... So then we're just extrapolating. We think it's getting better now, so we're assuming it will continue to do
we
that.
Also,
which, if that's the answer, that's the answer. But
we also anticipate that the employment situation will continue, will increase in the spring, and we anticipate that tourists visit the city, they will utilize the rail system, and tourists use the rail system more than they use the bus system.
Okay. The second part of that statement there on the slide about the bus service, bus ridership, D.C. population is the factor most influencing. Now, let me ask you, why is not D.C. employment?
You're referring to the second main bullet on the slide.
The last bullet,
this,
second
this
clause.
One here. This one, yes. I believe there was an editing error that was made by Metro on this slide. The last version that I had seen didn't write it exactly this way. In the weekday models,
yes.
The weekday models are dependent on employment as the primary variable because there's obviously a cross-correlation between population and employment and their effect on ridership, so you can't have them both in the model at the same time. We have run models with both of these we've run individual models, estimated models with employment as the variable, estimated models with population as the variable. So we've learned and can convey that information about how those variables affect ridership when they're in the models by themselves. They can't both be in the model at the same time because they're cross-correlated. For the weekend models, we found better fit overall. So we choose our models based on the fit of the model. As I know you're aware, population is in the weekends. It should say employment for weekday and population for weekend. That's the conclusion.
By population, you mean resident population?
It is D.C. resident population.
That hasn't changed a whole lot month to month.
It's
whereas employment has. So I can understand it being employment. I can understand, to get back to the earlier point your colleague was just making, if the bus service, bus ridership has dropped more dramatically, it's not entirely surprising to me given that the district has had a big spike in unemployment in this period. And they have the bulk of the bus service. So that's not terribly surprising. That makes some sense. That's intuitive. But then the second part of it does imply then something about how the employment may or may not change. For instance, to get the result that, about which I am asking, I would think you'd have something that says employment isn't going to get much better in the district, therefore bus ridership isn't going to recover so much. But other factors tell us that more people will be riding the rail system relative than they would.
When we've looked at the factors that impact rail ridership and bus ridership, we found that it is much more accurate, it's much easier to project rail ridership. The factors, and this is in the reflected in the Cambridge model, the ridership on bus is very hard to predict. And the greatest correlation, in fact, has been D.C. residents in the District of Columbia. Personally, for me, it's a rough one to explain. Because, and Jay, if you could comment on that, I mean,
well, it's just been more. Maybe you did more just explain it, because to the extent that it's a more variable, that was a higher variance around the estimate, then yes, the cruder number, which varies more over time, it would mean you'd be better off in a shorter time frame, you're going to be less accurate in predicting, which is kind of what you seem to be telling me we have. I would add to that that we don't do as good a job measuring it either. With the rail system, we have pretty good numbers who's going in and who's going out.
That's correct.
I'm not confident we actually know who's on the bus system.
We do have greater data, we have better data on the rail system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, let me follow up on that for just a moment, and then we'll go to Mr. Giantola. What I thought I heard you say earlier is that on the rail system, you normally do project tourism picking up in the spring.
That's correct.
And that's in all of your existing estimates.
That's correct.
And that you're saying that you expect that tourism to come regardless of the fact that there is, or a substantial part of that tourism to come, regardless of the fact that there is an economic downturn at the present time.
We don't project that we will ever meet any of our monthly budget numbers that were adopted for FY10. The closest we anticipate will come is in the last fiscal month, 1% below budget.
That's good news.
So we've projected that we'll never meet our numbers. We do anticipate that we will get closer to the budgeted numbers because of tourists. But that you point out a risk if the current economic condition continues, and that reduced tourists, that's a risk to the forecast.
But I think what I heard you saying is that the employment, which is one factor, you're continuing to see down, but maybe moderating.
Correct.
And then tourism, which would be another factor that could go down at the same rate, you're saying is not going to go down at the same rate, at least in your current projections.
Our projections are against budget, and if I guess I can't answer that question. I could follow up on the specific variable of tourism, if I might.
Because that would seem like the only thing that would cause the moderation that Mr. Zimmerman was talking about.
Matt? Just one thing on the rail model, we do have gas price and hotel room. With bus, it's just employment. And if we look ahead to FY11, it looks like job growth is modest. I think it's 0.5% for Moody's, but it was actually gas prices that are expected to go up as much as 11%, and hotel room by 1.5% that are driving rail. So because you got more commuting trips on rail, I think that's one of the reasons we see that bouncing back then.
So you're seeing gas prices moderating the effect in the spring, going into 2011.
Right, and that we don't have that variable in the bus model, just in rail.
Okay.
Let me just get a clarification. I'm reading ahead in some of your other charts here, page 42, 45, and 46. Is the estimate that's best case forecast there based on this model? I'm assuming it is, right? Are these projections best case projections based on your model?
It's an annual projection.
But it's a new model, right?
It's a model, and it agrees with the results from Cambridge.
And what's the worst-case scenario on some of these? I mean, you know, it's nice to know what the best case is, but how bad could it get? I mean, what's your variance again on each one, bus, rail? Is it plus or minus 1%, 2%?
When we compare our results to Cambridge, it was 1.3 on rail and 3.1 on bus, and that was the original. It wasn't the best or the worst. It was anticipated.
But they're different on rail and bus, your confidence level on that?
I wouldn't describe it as a confidence level. I'd just describe it as a difference between model results.
Yeah, it'd be nice to know what the worst-case scenario is on these. And then the last question I have relates to Metro Access. How did you figure that out? I didn't hear, you know, how do you do your best case and worst case in that particular one? What parameters do you use to do that one?
That's based on year-to-date trips.
Did you model that, or is that just the older projections?
That's the projections? Older. That's the older.
You didn't model Metro Access?
No, we did not.
All right, okay.
Mr. Kent is coming up. Do you want to add to that, Mr. Kent?
Well, we used a different actuary for our modeling, and it's been based on a number of factors that we've spoken about before here, including the effect of social programs elsewhere in the region, downsizing and that ridership migrating over to us, things, operational changes like the introduction of door-to-door service and how that makes the service appealing, and certainly we've accumulated a lot of historical data from the previous study and, you know, our own recent high increases of ridership over the last few years with 20% year-on-year increases.
So you're saying some of the major things that are affecting this are policy issues as opposed to economic issues and policy issues by organizations other than Metro?
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. McKay.
Yeah, I am looking at the parking transactions, and I need an explanation for that because obviously on the Metro Rail ridership, we're emphasizing the shorter trips and that, you know, growth in population activities in central cores and influencing that, and the shorter trips is eroding rail average fare, which may in fact be the case, but of course, you know, parking is kind of an indicator of longer trips since that's where our parking is, and I'm looking at the parking chart and I'm seeing, if anything, an increase in FY10 over FY9 as a best case, a worst case, and it's hard to tell on this graph, is at least it's even. So how do you reconcile your statistics on short trips with your projected parking transactions not eroding?
The parking utilization that we've seen at the lots has been consistent year over year compared month to month. And I think that's something that the board has asked previously. Where we've seen decreases is in the use of our meters and in the use of our of the reserve parking, for fewer people purchasing reserve parking. But as far as the parking lot utilization, it's been about the same year over year. And I hear your point about reconciling with the longer and the shorter trips. And that's something that we will continue to look into. But we have seen the drop in the longer trips. Parking utilization, which you're correct, would appear to reflect longer trips. Utilization does not appear to.
Yeah, I think we need to continue to look at that because it's not reconciling in my mind with the statements that are made about short trips, and you know, frankly, I don't know if there's other influencing factors, if there's reductions in bus routes or other things that might be contributing to people taking their cars where before, you know, they might have been arriving by bus. I don't know what other factors are out there, but I think it's an interesting point that we have no erosion in parking and yet a perceived erosion in long trips on the rail.
Let me note that statement is, at least as I remember, inconsistent with statements that have been made before when we try to explain the fact that our parking revenues are below budget.
Yes.
They are below.
That's right. No, in the past, we have, and we can give the board the information, and we are analyzing it because there are lots where we have 100% utilization, and then there's lots where we're down to this 85, 85-89% average, and we are looking at that. But in the past, we have indicated that the reserved parking revenue has gone down significantly, and our riders are smart because they don't need to pay $55 a month to get a reserved parking, because there is some areas where they can get a vacant spot, or they can come earlier and get a spot. So they're looking at their pocketbooks as well, and that's affecting it, as well as the meter revenue that that Matt had indicated. But we can show you the analysis by all of the stations.
I'd like to see that.
Mr. Lynn.
Thank you.
Two things. One, there's also a pent-up demand for parking at some places that there are people who actually have gone to garages, and the garage has been full, and they've moved away, and now some of these spaces are available, so you don't see that in your revenues. So you know, that's affecting some garages. I know the one that I use, I'm now finding some spaces when I get there, and I didn't before, so I'm starting to go. But once, those places are full, that's some of the pent-up demand. The other issue, I think the Cambridge model and the interaction between the 2 miles that's been developed would be helpful to be presented to the JCC, our group, that has an opportunity to really look at these matters. I know that they, you guys have come to us today, but it'd be helpful if at one of their meetings this could be put on the agenda, and there's an opportunity for the model to be discussed.
I think that's a good point. We have presented to the JCC on a couple items about the budget. We discussed the ridership assumptions that we've used. Initially, we had proposed a 2% increase in bus and 2% in rail. The information that we got from the JCC is they thought that the bus projection was too high. From that feedback and some other work, we reduced it to 1.5%. But we're certainly happy to report back to the JCC, explain the Cambridge model, and provide some more information.
Can we make that a request by the committee, a formal request by the committee then?
Absolutely. I would do it anyway, but yes, absolutely.
Okay. Any other comments at this point? All right. Would you like to continue with your presentation, Mr. Brown?
Thank you. The next slide talks about rail ridership, and we've touched on some of these issues. Rail ridership obviously has increased over the years expanded service. We've expanded service past midnight. We've opened new lines. We've opened new stations. We anticipate. We do anticipate a shortfall against budget this year, and the forecasts that we presented to the board previously are reflected in the numbers you see on this slide. I may note that in 2009, the Obama inauguration did give an unbudgeted boost to our ridership of about 1.8 million trips. You may notice two blips or irregularities on that slide. 2003 and 2007 were two that I noticed. 2003, we had a massive snowstorm that we think impacted ridership. And finally, in 2007, we experienced lower than expected employment growth. So those are the reasons why we think we did not meet budget in those 2 years. But this rail ridership information and the forecast that's presented here is consistent with what we presented to the board previously. Next is something we've been talking about. This presents some data, and note that this data is from January to June, from 2008 to 2009. We saw the same trend when we looked at, when we started comparing 2007 to 2008 data. Now, when we compared the 2007 to 2008 data, it was before we were in the employment situation and the economic situation that we're in now. When we compared the 2007 and the 2008 data, though, we did see a growth in short trips. We didn't see the same decrease in longer trips, but for at least 2 years now, we've seen growth in the shorter trips. It seems to reflect a couple things, changing use of our rail system as people are using it less as a commuter system, or in addition to using our system as a commuter system, also using it, using transit as a lifestyle choice. We believe that the decrease in long trips is related to the employment situation. And just to give you an idea of the difference in the trips here, one of our shortest trips is between Gallery Place and Metro Center. I think most people would walk that, but that's a pretty short trip at 0.29 composite miles. The longest trip, the 30-mile trip, is Franconia Springfield and to Shady Grove, and that's at 29.44 composite miles. And then we look at metro rail ridership. We all know that metro rail ridership varies by time of day. What we have tried to do is normalize and reflect boardings by these different periods. Now, keep in mind that these periods are different lengths. The PM peak, for example, is 4 hours. AM peak is 3.5. During the PM peak in that 4 hours, you actually have more boardings than the AM peak. It's just the difference in the time periods. Mr. Benjamin, one of the things that we've talked about before is the PM peak, the 66,000 trips, not only reflects employment, but it reflects those who are going to after-work activities, dinners, and special events, things like that. We've also shown on the right side of the chart in red an average typical Saturday. Saturday day trips are closer in levels to what we experienced midday, Monday through Friday. And then we've also put on this chart the about 13,000 trips that occur after midnight. During 12 and 2, we charge reduced fares, and during the late night from 2 to 3, we charge regular, or what some people would term premium fares.
And your 256 after midnight is cleanup of people who are leaving the system?
Right, it's the people running for the trains at the when stations close. It's the last runs on those trains. That's correct. Metro bus ridership, as we've talked about, is less predictable. The ridership is more erratic. Mr. Zimmerman, as you pointed out, our estimate on the forecast for 2010 is more conservative than rail. The budgeted ridership for FY10 is 139 million trips. Actual ridership is expected to be in the range of about 130 million trips. And finally, the access ridership that I think we've already touched on, we anticipate that the FY10 experience will be higher than what's budgeted. Finally, and this is something that we consider both with the forecast and as we work on our FY11 budget, the subsidy per passenger varies by mode. The greatest subsidy, as you know, is provided for Metro Access riders. For bus and rail, there's a greater cost recovery ratio for rail. So therefore, our rail ridership is more sensitive. So the effects are compounded. When we lose rail ridership, we lose more dollars than we do on bus ridership, so it's more sensitive in the forecast. So our current fare policy principles, and what do our current fares reflect? Number one, charge rails based on distance traveled. Our system is set up so that the longer one travels, the more he or she pays. Number two, there are instances where we charge for what I would call premium service. We talked about reserved parking, airport shuttles, parking during Redskins home games. We try to maximize the use of existing capacity. We charge lower fares at off-peak periods than we do at peak periods and try to encourage riders. Number four, we encourage transfers between modes. We try to get people out of their cars at rail stations and onto our system. We have the bus-to-rail and rail-to-bus transfers. We allow a three-hour transfer period from bus to bus. We provide discounted fares for some riders, for students, for persons with disabilities, for the elderly. Number six, we try to collect revenue in a cost-effective manner. We try to encourage the use of Smart Trip. In fact, we require it at our parking lots, with the exception of the six demonstration lots that also have credit card readers. That helps reduce our long-term costs of dealing with paper money and coins. And finally, seven, we charge twice the Metrobus service for the access fares. There's an additional charge for zones out that are three-quarters of a mile outside of our fixed route. So I think these are what our current fares reflect.
May I stop you for a moment,
please,
Mr. Brown? Because you made a statement that was very correct. I want to make sure that it's understood by everybody, and that is when you say we're charging more for premium services, we aren't saying that we charge more in the peak than in the off-peak. It's really the opposite. There are some special things that we do charge more for, but our regular fares are the fares that we charge in the peak. And then, as you show in number three, we give a discount during the off-peak in order to maximize our capacity. The service levels that we provide are those that are necessary in order to meet the demand to the degree that we can do it, or policy headways when you get to low demand periods. And you said that quite correctly. Thank you.
Last year, we made some ridership changes. In January of 2009, we eliminated paper transfers, made some other changes. To this point, we don't see any evidence that these policies have changed our ridership behavior. We have realized, and I think it's the fourth bullet down, we had estimated as part of our FY10 budget that we would realize $10 million from the elimination of paper transfers. To date, we estimate that that's about $7 million, but that's something positive that we don't think has impacted our ridership, or use of the buses. But it is additional $7 million that we will receive annually. So that's the point of this is just to say that even with these changes, we do not believe that we've seen changes in our rider in the behavior of our riders. Finally, as we look forward to recommended fare policies, what policy decisions do we want our fares to reflect? What are we going to discuss as part of the FY11 budget? The first few are things that we believe we should continue. Charge more for rail fares based on the distance traveled. That's something we should continue. Charge more for premium services and maybe consider additional premium services that we can provide. And again, there was a great Washington Post article that talked about willingness of people to pay to various stations and other ideas, that things that I think we should consider as we consider we talk about the FY11 budget. Maximize the use of existing capacity. We might be able to do that by introduce, and I think there was support among the JCC for doing this, for introducing a fare differential on rail between paper and smart trip transactions. Number four, facilitate movement between bus, rail, and the jurisdictional bus systems. That's something that we've done, and I think that's something that we continue. Continue to provide discounts to some riders. I think it's appropriate to give discounts to the elderly, persons with disabilities, students. Collect revenue in a cost-effective manner. We're continuing to try to find ways to increase the use of Smart Trip. That helps reduce the, I mentioned this earlier, it helps reduce the amount of cash that we have to deal with, lowers our costs. The next one, something that I think we should consider is achieving greater parity between passes and the cash fare. There's a disparity there between those two. I think it's something we should consider as part of the FY11 budget. And then finally, and something that Mr. Kent has talked about, looking at the Metro Access fare policy, we're allowed to charge up to twice the comparable fixed route route. We charge less than that currently. As we look at the access, both in access services that we're providing, we should also look at the fare policy.
Question.
Mr. Zimmerman.
First, you said several times on discounts you referred to students. I'm not aware that our tariff has any student discount.
Any of the jurisdictions, and
yes,
I should have
our tariff has no student discount.
Many of the jurisdictions.
I support having a student discount. I have supported it in my jurisdiction, but just for the record, it is not a Metro student discount.
That's correct.
But what strikes me about this list, some of the items here are principles on which one might base a fare policy. It could be parts of a fare policy.
Okay.
Some of them are goals that you would like a fare policy to achieve. Charging rail fares based on distance traveled is a way of structuring fares. And you don't even say rail, because in a certain sense, we've done that on bus as well, more limited way with express services. Maximizing the use of existing capacity by encouraging new riders to try that is a goal which presumably would inform a fare policy. So I don't know where this is going, but presumably it's going to head us toward actually having a fare policy at some point. I think you need to make a distinction between the things that you want to achieve through a fare policy and the principles by which you would structure fares that presumably reflect the former. Thank you.
Mr. Linton, and then Mr. Graham.
I had a similar comment on the ridership and impact of recent fare policy changes, because some of the things that were done there were not policy changes. So I think we need to be consistent in what we think is actually fair policy. And other things are either collection strategies or efforts to achieve a fair policy. But that's something that probably is something that needs to have a good discussion among the board, because we need to discuss what is the fair policy.
Mr. Graham.
And thank you. And in fact, the fair policy is outlined in skeletal form in the resolution which you refer to in this presentation. And you do quote from this resolution insofar as one of the resolve clauses, and you do respond to it. Where is the response to the other resolve clauses? Those are the other elements.
There's a future slide where we talk about the service guarantees. There are other items in the policy, for example.
Where is that future slide?
I'm sorry, it's the next slide in this deck. Back one, please.
Next steps.
This was the this is where we looked at other transit services and the guarantees were offered.
Well, it's not quite what, I mean, I don't want to quibble, but it's not quite the same type of thorough response that we've had to the one resolve clause. There are two other resolve clauses, which I think all of which constitute our, quote, fair policy as set forth in that particular resolution. And when I requested this information, maybe others did too, but I did request it, I was looking for a response to the entire resolution, and I don't find that.
There are two other resolves. Maybe we can respond in writing if that is helpful. But
I think it would be better if you responded in writing. I would like the same kind of thoughtful, and this is very thoughtful, responses you've given us today to the other issues.
Absolutely.
Okay, if you don't mind, if we can.
We can do that.
So this is a kind of a repetition of the request.
If you'd like to continue.
I would. The items here, this is how our service guarantees compare with the other service providers. Our current policy is to refund rail boarding fare when patrons enter and exit the same station during service delays. I understand we've done that five times over the last fiscal year.
Yeah, and I can elaborate if you like. The service guarantee policy that we have in place currently focuses primarily on major service disruptions, which are defined as service disruptions that are 30 minutes or longer. When those occur on our system, actually, and we actually allow our customers to exit fare gates, the OCC, the control center, informs the fare table, and what's implemented is a zero fare policy. So as the customers are exiting the fare gates as they entered, they didn't get the ride, they're now exiting, they're not charged for that ride. That is how we implement one portion of the service guarantee. The other way we implement the service guarantee policy is through these fare adjustment envelopes. Actually, I have an example here, which every station manager has. And if a customer has an issue with their fare card, or if it's an issue with the service, they can actually approach the station manager, fill out this form. The station manager fills it out. There's about six or seven items for why the service was not acceptable to the customer, if there was an issue with the particular fare media, if it did not work. And then this is mailed actually to our revenue collections facility, and then a refund is provided back to the customer. So those, and we can get you, certainly, Mr. Graham, numbers on what those are, but just on a high-level view for this specific piece, we probably get about 3,000 transactions a month with this, and they range anywhere from a $5 value to something lower than that. But we can get you the detail on it month to month and how we implement that. But that's how it compares to some of the other service guarantee programs that are other transits.
Mr.
Linton.
I'm not going to quibble with that. I think it was during our budget a couple of years, a couple of years ago that I asked for an examination of our fare guarantee when we had some issues with our customers and trying to make sure that we were responding to some of their pain and that we were going to raise the level of service because we were asking for a fare increase. And quite frankly, I think our fare policy or our fare guarantee is equal to the CTA and the MTA. We are without a service guarantee policy. I don't think what was referenced was actually a service guarantee policy. I think the only transit properties where that actually exists is MBTA, New York sector, which is actually constitutes a guarantee because you get fare when your service is not provided. Anything else other than that is not really a service guarantee.
And I would agree with you. Actually, SEPTA, we met with SEPTA yesterday, which we view as having a very good service guarantee program. And we met with their chief, who implements that, the other day when they were in town. And we'd like to actually bring back a recommendation for implementing a service guarantee program that reflects that model. They gave us some lessons learned on how they implemented it. It was very costly in the beginning. And then as service increased or service was better, performance was better, it actually now cost them very little to operate a service guarantee program. And they're achieving a lot more benefits in terms of new riders versus the cost of the program.
I actually referenced SEPTA and suggested that the staff look at SEPTA when I made the suggestion of examining a fair policy guarantee. At the time of the resolution. So I very specifically identified both during the discussion and after when I talked with the staff about where they could look at a model. So 2 years later, we're looking at it.
Well, you have my commitment that we're already looking at it.
And I think you've heard that many members of the board and of this committee do like the idea of a service guarantee of some sort, and I think I heard you say that if you come back with a proposal to the board, it will include what the revenue loss is likely to be, so we can take that into account in the process. Mr. Albert.
What is the service guarantee for the bus riders?
We currently don't have a service guarantee for bus riders, and the SEPTA model doesn't have one either because it's impacted by too many variables that are not in their control.
Yeah.
Traffic, major. Yeah. So if it's tied to performance, it's unable to be implemented.
Bus goes out of service, you're delayed for work. I mean, there's some things that are within, to some extent, your control.
There are some things, and we're exploring SEPTA, but right now they don't even have the program because they view that it's not a controllable factor in terms of real performance, the uncontrollable.
So we don't think we should have one? Are you exploring one?
I'm exploring one with SEPTA, and I'm just making reference to what I feel is the best practices in the industry, as Mr. Litton has indicated. And there are some challenges with it, but we'll explore it, definitely.
Okay. Any other questions? You want to move on?
The very next slide before we get to the appendix, and the appendix contains a lot of information, a lot of data about time of day, fiscal years, and we won't go through the appendix in detail. This is the calendar for the current calendar for the budget process. The board resolution, the board will receive the 2011 budget books at the board meeting. February, if necessary, board action to begin public hearing process. March, any necessary public hearings. May, final review of the 2011 budget. Results of public hearings, approval if necessary of fare increases and service reductions. In June, board approval of the budget. This list, I think we need to add, as is requested by the board, a look at fare policies and then those things that we're looking to achieve through our fares. So I'll add that in some format in months. The presentation, I think, is what was requested. And this doesn't include the JCC and other meetings that we'll, of course, attend. I've attended the JCC the last couple times. I spoke to the Riders Advisory Council, I believe it was a week ago. Those additional items would be.
If I remember correctly, you had a dollar number target for revenues that might be generated next year by a fare increase. And you had another dollar number target for service reductions many, many, many times larger than what we just talked about last week. Are you talking about coming back in February with a proposed set of fare changes that would generate those numbers, something higher than that, something lower than that?
Well, the budget book that we're presenting on the 28th to the board will be the balanced budget as presented by the general manager to the board, which will include a fare increase to close the gap and also include the level of service reductions that we have in there.
That's a broad number. I'm saying if we're going to go to public hearing, you have to have a very specific proposal that we would be willing to take out to the public. Mm-hmm. You know, where it says this fare goes up this amount, that fare goes up that amount, here are services that get down, and here's how much they go down. Is that what you're telling us?
We will have that in the budget book. That'll be a table in the budget book that shows
actual proposals for service and fare changes.
Yes.
That's correct.
Right.
And one of the things that the Riders Advisory Council and others have asked us to present are not only those things that we chose, but the things that we did not choose or the other options. We're working on a presentation both on the fare increases and on the service reductions that would show those things that we proposed to close the budget gap, as Ms. Kissel has indicated, but also show those other possible service reductions or fare increases that could have chosen or the board could consider as we look through the budget.
So you're going to propose a menu that could conceivably be larger than the amount that you think is the shortfall?
We will propose, the general manager will make a recommendation on how to close the budget gap. We'll also include information about other things that could be considered that are not part of the general manager's recommendation, as requested by the Riders Advisory Council.
Yeah, I guess the concern I have is I don't know that this committee or the board would be ready to go to public hearing in a way that essentially ties our hands 1 month from now, that says this is all we can do if we want to try and balance the budget. We're going to want to go, first of all, we're going to want to see if there are other cuts we can make to the budget, and then second of all, we're going to want to know that we have some degree of flexibility.
I think generally the practice is that we go to public hearing with a menu greater than what's required and consider the input received from the public. Make a selection.
Yeah. It's been a desire that has not been our practice. So I guess it's not clear to me that this committee would be prepared to vote on something like that a month from now. And therefore, you may find yourself in an interesting schedule problem, especially if we haven't had a chance to take a look at how much we might be able to reduce the shortfall through other means. And if we don't do what some people have suggested, and that is, I can see us potentially going to public hearing with service reductions and fare increases that are substantially more than what we think we would need in total, thereby giving us some room to maneuver as we take a look at all the other issues. But I find it hard to believe that we're going to go with a minimal set that constrains us on the far end to, we got to go ahead and do that. I don't know whether others here would like to comment on whether it's reasonable to assume that we're going to go to public hearing in February.
I think it's,
Mr. Graham?
I think it's a little early, and I think it's a little early to actually speculate as to any approach at this point, because we're still, I mean, in the old days, my old days here, we were just beginning. We'd be beginning the budget process right now, and so, you know, I mean, it's well to keep in mind that we're still more or less at the start of this. And it's hard to predict any decision by this board.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Of course, one of the differences in the past has been that the budget was mostly about how we would allocate a small increment that we were getting for the coming year. And the actions the board would be taking were fairly minimal. We are involved now in making decisions over more of the budget because of the situation that confronts us. So I guess my question is, whether you do hearings in March or April, whenever you do them. So the question to me is, how soon do we get on the table the various menus from which one will have to choose to put together a budget? When would anybody be seeing the kinds of things that you're looking at, apart from even what the general manager might recommend? When can people see the range of choices over the various parts of the billion-dollar program here, that would be adjusted potentially in order to meet a budget.
We'll have all of that information in the budget.
Well, okay, so you're going to say, you're saying the budget presentation is going to have a recommended budget and then X tens of millions of dollars of alternatives that...
Of other options.
And that will be presented when?
It'll be presented at the board meeting on the 28th, which is what was requested in the resolution that was passed. So it's very detailed.
You're talking about not presenting. You're talking about handing it out to us.
That's correct. I apologize.
Mr. Zimmerman is saying
the document 2 weeks from now will have a document that, in fact, is going to have all of that.
That's correct.
The thing is that in the past, when we ask for alternatives or options, what we get is usually some minor thing that suggests something that would tweak the original a little bit and would have some dollar value. We haven't, for instance, last week, when we asked for alternatives, and what we saw was one minor tweak that increased the amount that could be saved from one thing and then eliminated another thing. Not quite the menu that we're talking about here. So I'm a little skeptical. I obviously don't know. You know better what it is you'll show us in 2 weeks. If it's going to be that full menu, well, then I'd be less concerned about the schedule we have here, and I think that might answer Mr. Benjamin's question. If, on the other hand, what it means is we're going to say, yeah, we still need alternatives, and we have to send you back, and you promise you're going to get us them next month, then you know, we might have a problem.
I can tell you this, that the budget book is very detailed. It has detailed information by service, by mode, by department, by headcount, by every expense item. It includes every possible solution that we could think of. There might be more that the board determines, and that's great. But it includes fares, it includes capital, it includes preventative maintenance programs, it includes campaigns that we've discussed with the board in the past, it includes reductions in staff, it includes adjustments in service schedule. So those are the primary items that it includes.
Something we can really sink our teeth into.
Yes, I hope so. I hope it's something you can actually sink your teeth in. It's very comprehensive.
Are you finished, Mr. Zimmerman?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Lutton.
I would hope that we get some real clarity from the board as to their expectations on what you are proposing. It's very important before you provide it that you're clear about what it is exactly they're expecting from what you presented. And if there's a way of, you know, getting that from this board, I would suggest that you try to do that.
Well, the guidance that we used to build the book was the resolution that was passed by the board in fall, I believe, that it had 4 or 5 points that we use as guidelines. That is the direction that we use, although I understand that there's further direction. And
I have been, my tenure on this board is nowhere near Mr. Graham's, but I have repeatedly seen instances where what was reflected in guidance would seem to convey what the board's interests were interpreted differently by both the board and the staff. I'm just suggesting one more effort to try to make sure that there's actually some clear agreement before you present it be made. That's just some advice, and you can do that or not do that. What I don't want is what I've seen happen here so often, is the board has an expectation that is different than what the staff has provided, and board members blow up. And I would like to try to avoid that.
Other comments, or are we complete with this presentation?
Okay.
Shall we move on to our other information item, which is our financials? And if you can, reflect for us as you go through those, how these financials relate to some of the projections that you were making for the remainder of this year and the basis for 2011, that would be very good. Mr. Brown?
Sure. I'll handle that. The This begins on page 72. The data and the text start on page 73. I'd just like to point out that the revenue variance to date is $22 million. As of November, that was considered in our forecast. The expense variance to date, $7.4 million. We'll get into the details of that in just a second. If you'll turn to the second page, that's a piece of information that I was searching for earlier. If you look at the average weekday ridership on our rail system from July to November, decreases over the previous fiscal year are lessening. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, thanks. So we've gone from 3.82% in July down to 1.15% in November, and that's one of the reasons that we think we'll get closer to the budget, and that's reflected in our forecast. If now I could turn your attention to the summary of the operating expenses, and that is on page 85 of your packet. The rail variance against budget of 2.7% is less than what it was last month, 3.4%, reflecting the trend that we talked about earlier. On bus, it's about the same. Last month, our variance was about 1.1%. On access, it's about the same. Overall, as I mentioned earlier, we've experienced a $22.2 million shortfall against budget on revenues. For the entire fiscal year, given the step-up approach, given the models that we've talked about, the Cambridge Systematics, we anticipate that that'll be closer to $38 million. On the expense side, our variance is $7.4 million. We do anticipate by the end of the fiscal year that the variance will be about $2 million. And the reason of that is the timing of some of our expenditures. During the first part of the fiscal year, we incurred more than expected costs for salary and supplies due to the Red Line accident. And also in the second half of the fiscal year, we're anticipating some benefits that are not budgeted. There's a health payment that we anticipate receiving from our health provider of about $1.5 million. So some of this is related to the timing of expenditures. So we think that some of the expenditures, even those for supplies, have fallen more in the first half of the year than we had anticipated in the budget. I would point out that the highlight is the variance against power, diesel, CNG. The year-to-date, we have a positive variance of $6.5 million. By the end of the fiscal year, we anticipate that between fuel, power, and utilities to produce a positive variance of about $15 million. And that's going to offset some of the expenditure pressures that we've talked about earlier, including the increase in our liability insurance.
And do you put that down to swaps that we've done, or what is the reason for that?
It's for the fuel swaps and derivatives on the diesel and also propulsion implementing.
Are there any questions about the financials?
Mr. Bender?
Yes.
Not about the financials, but I have one other announcement. I just wanted to tell the committee that I'm going to hand out the notice of the public hearing docket. It's a draft format, but we actually are anticipating sending out a final this evening. So Lloyd is going to hand those out to each of you.
This is for the meeting on the hearing on the 27th?
That's correct.
Where is that?
Mr. Zimmerman.
Since I guess we're approaching the end here.
Yes.
So
I hope so.
The questions that we had staff had followed up with and sent us last night, I guess, these answers to which I referred earlier, there are several others, and some of them relate to what we've been discussing here. The question about what's happening in ridership, which the answer that's given here is essentially the first answer I think that was given in the meeting. which basically says, well, crowding's not much down because ridership's not really down that much, which I think is a valid point, especially for the orange line. I originally asked about ridership by line, and I think when you looked at the numbers which they provided that, you do see that the striking thing is that the big, what's often ridership is the red line, which isn't that surprising, particularly in the earlier part of the fiscal year when it was way down. So, you know, I think that is some of the answer, that, in fact, if you only have a 2% drop in the ridership, you're not necessarily going to see it show up a lot in crowding. Not sure that that's all the answer, though, and I think that we do need to be looking at not only the question of why at lower ridership we still have high crowding, but the question of whether these issues are, you know, causally related in the other direction as well. That we'll lose riders because people have trouble getting on trains. I also, you know, I suggested at that meeting that the capacity of the system, in fact, is lower right now. And nobody seems to disagree with that. Well, we haven't really found a way to quantify this. But a couple of things are, you know, suggesting that. One, of course, being that we're riding on manual. And I do think we need to understand better how operating 100% on manual 100% of the time affects the capacity of the system. I think we need to understand that better in quantitative terms, what that means. I know that this morning, I was fortunate enough to be riding on the yellow line, which went well. A colleague of mine here had the misfortune of being on the orange line this morning. I will say that while I was on the yellow line, I got a report from another rider, constituent, about what was going on in the orange line, about which I would like a report. But I'd like to know what it is happened on the orange line this morning. Occasion what seems to be a large gap in trains, but I'm really interested in it not because it's one morning thing, but because I have the sense that this may be typical and may have something to do with the overall issue we're facing. If you wind up, instead of having 3 or 4 minute spacing in the very peak and having 7 minute spacing, one of the things that happens is, you know, people start accumulating more, and then when the train comes in, it's hard to get them off, and then the operator is forced to tell people, need you to stand clear of the doors, can't move, and we may have to offload the train. And everybody's heard that kind of message been in that situation, which I gather there was a lot of this morning on the orange line. But the point is, though, that causes further slowing, because now it takes longer to move that train along. And these things become cumulative, which is precisely what, you know, leads to the problems that you have in peak times. So we need to look very closely at all the factors that may contribute to that. Anything that slows it down a little bit can wind up being amplified to a much bigger delay. One of the things that has not been looked at that I would like to ask be examined has to do with the change in practice that we instituted last spring. For the 33 years up until last spring, as far as I know, this system was run by trains pulling up to a mark in the station based on the size of the consist. If it was a two-car train, which used to operate, there's a mark, there's a flag that says two-car stops here. If it was a four-car, then it goes farther up. Six cars farther still, so that the train would be centered in the platform. In the last several years, we started running eight-car trains, and those have to go all the way to the end because the platforms are just big enough for eight cars. And that's where we started running into some issues in the last year or so. It seemed to me all of a sudden it was an issue. I don't remember exactly what point it did, where some eight-car trains pulled up to the six-car mark instead of the end of the platform, leaving trains hanging in the tunnel. And this, of course, you know, made news stories before we had other problems even this year. And the solution to that has been to have every train pull up to the end of the platform. As far as I know, it has worked in that we haven't had the tail ends of eight-car trains in the tunnels. On the other hand, it means all the trains are pulling all the way up. And apart from the inconvenience to riders who've had to learn different places on the platform where they want to be and all that, I wonder whether there aren't other consequences that have to do with the efficiency of the system. I'm just noticing what happens. I mean, it means that for six-car trains, which is still the bulk of the trains that we run, there's one end of the platform that has to become more populated. And it's a complicated question because our stations actually vary a lot in where the mezzanine is and where escalators come down. In some stations, I think there may be a safety issue because we wind up squeezing a lot of people into areas that are fairly narrow inside platform stations. But it seems to me that it can create efficiency problems in offloading and loading the trains. The most obvious example being right there at Gallery Place. When if you come from here,
and need to get on a red line train, then when you go down, the train pulls in, it's down the other end of the platform, the side platform on the red level, and all the people who are coming off are heading back, and if you're coming down at that point, you can't get anywhere into the train. So the immediate annoyance is probably the train takes off, even though you were there and you couldn't get to it. But we have large numbers of people trying to do this, and it seems to me that that's likely to affect the time that that train alights at that station. If that kind of thing is in one way or another widespread to some degree, seconds here, seconds there adds up. So I would like, Mr. Chairman, that the staff examine the question of this operation that we've been doing for the last 6, 7, 8 months, whatever it is, and what impact it might have on the efficiency of the system. I don't think it would explain everything, but I suspect we have a cumulative number of little things that are all contributing to the system not functioning quite as smoothly. And if that's so, that will affect ridership, which affects fares, which affects our budget. That's my request.
Inherent, Mr. Zimmerman, in that question is your belief that if we were on automatic control, we would be more likely not to have to deal with those issues?
Yes, I believe that. I think that it is probably true that automatic train control in the highest peak times, and it affects the smoothness of the ride all the time, and therefore riders' perceptions, are affected. But it probably affects efficiency only at peak times when things are really tightly jammed. And I suspect that manual operation is not as successful at operating that smoothly, and so we're probably slowing down and losing some of the efficiencies we gain. And I'd add to that that one of the things that was a problem with 8-car trains, we never got to automatic train control for 8-car trains. We were getting close to that. I believe it was to have been implemented in July. But at any rate, I know we were getting very close. So we had an efficiency gain we never realized that we were on the verge of realizing, which we won't be able to do until we get back to automatic train control. We've gone the other way by going manual with everything.
Continuing our discussions on the monthly financials, Mr. Graham.
Oh, right, on the monthly financials.
You have something beyond the monthly financials?
Beyond the monthly financials.
Can I talk, then ask Mr. Giancola to follow up on his issue?
Yeah, I want to comment on Mr. Zimmerman's comments. As, again, a daily user, I would certainly agree that we need to find out more impacts on the operations. But I would disagree that moving the trains to the most forward position may cause confusion. In fact, for the regular rider, they like the consistency of knowing where the car is going to be. So my experience and people that I know use the Metro daily prefer to have a set location each time when they come into a rail station. So I would argue that I don't think we're losing efficiencies there for our regular riders because they know where to go to get on the train. Now, it certainly may be a crowded train, and that may be another issue we need to explore, but at least at that element, the consistency is most important to the people like myself or that I know ride the train.
Just to clarify, I'm not saying the inefficiency arises from people being confused because by now I agree that they've adjusted. My question, and it's a question that I think is evaluating, is whether because of the way stations are configured, disproportionately moving loading to one end of it may impact just the movement of people takes time.
Right. And I guess it depends on the station, because the station I get on, the train is at the front of the arrival point of the escalator. Acknowledged.
Are there any other comments on the financials? If not, Mr. Graham.
Thank you. I want to say how much I appreciate seeing the notice of public hearing in draft. And I'm pleased to be reassured that this has not been circulated, because I find the presentation of the issues as determined at our last board meeting to be not helpful. And what we're doing here is that we are providing, I don't know, it looks like about 20 pages of service cuts, which provide an awful lot of emphasis for what is but one option in a series of options that this board voted put out for public comment. And I'm also displeased by the fact that the preventative maintenance option, is now being described as capitalizing parts. And we were promised detail on this so that we could see what the long-term impacts were. And every member of this board expressed concern about that issue. And I agreed with it. But the way, a casual glance at the first three pages including the fact that the language on page one, the attachment to this document contains all of the details of the proposed changes in bus service, rail service, as well as fares and passes for bus and rail, doesn't even capture, you know, what are the options that this board has voted to present. And I don't want to get, I want to move to our executive session. I do not want to debate or argue with anyone here, but I do need to say that there are those of us who believe that this is not a choice between service reductions and fare increases. But the way this document has been structured, that is the inescapable suggestion. And so I'm glad to thank you so much for showing this to us. But this needs a major revision before it goes out. And I don't know how you're going to do it, but this is not capturing my sense of what happened at the board meeting.
We will welcome.
I don't know who wrote this, but I mean, if this goes out, I mean,
it will not go out, and okay. We would like to get comments from the members from the board. We can modify it.
Well, you've just gotten one comment.
Do we want to continue this discussion and comment on this, or shall we?
Well, I think that. I'm personally not willing to let the one comment be the only comment from.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman wants to comment.
I'm willing to defer to others who may, but I think there does need to be something.
Go ahead, Mr. Zimmerman.
Having just received this myself, I'm not sure I entirely understand, because I haven't actually seen the document, so I'm not sure I entirely understand to what Mr. Graham was referring. I assume that this provides the explanation of the service cuts that the general manager recommended.
What I'm referring to, if I may, Mr. Zimmerman,
please,
is that if you look at the options on page 3, term that is used over and over again is capitalized parts, capitalized some parts. This is news to me.
Clarify for me. I thought I remembered last week that there were two separate lines. One said capitalized parts, one said preventive maintenance. Yeah. I wasn't clear on what
that's correct.
It all meant, but. Yeah, and we asked for explanation. Mr. Graham and I both asked for explanation, which also is included in here.
But preventative maintenance is now nowhere to be found as a term. It isn't even presented as an option. Let me just speak for myself. I considered that to be a major option, fare increases and service reduction. I know there's controversy about that. I know there's strong feelings on the other side, and I respect them. But to find it nowhere.
Actually, it's on the last page, and it should not be on the last page.
The very last page?
Yeah. I apologize. It has a definition of the preventative maintenance.
I didn't get to the very last page.
I'd apologize. Me too. We'll take your comment and...
Oh, that one line that's in the back there?
No, it's towards the left.
Okay. Well, let me reiterate the request I made last time. While I am skeptical of this, I do agree with Mr. Graham that it should be on the table as part of the mix. If there's an easier alternative to raising fares or cutting service, well, gee, we'd all like that. I want to understand what it is. And, you know, again, we have very short description here, and the information that came last night doesn't really explain what the alternative is. I don't just need to know what you mean by the term parts capitalization. I need to know what it is you mean to do moving millions of dollars in a way that actually isn't going to cause any harm, or if it is, to understand what harm it will cause. That's successful. Did you follow that?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the question. Can you repeat it, please? I apologize.
I am looking not merely for the definition of the term parts capitalization as you use it, or
yes,
preventive maintenance. I want to know specifically, when you are proposing a change to any of these things on the order of millions of dollars, what that means, and what things will be affected, and how they will be affected, and when.
We would put that
in. I don't think we've seen yet. So that Mr. Graham actually can argue for something that we can understand what it is that would be the consequence of taking such action.
And I guess I would add to
you.
What Mr. Zimmerman said. What you say in here is, for instance, on parts capitalization, that this has to do with delay of purchase of buses from 2010
That's correct.
To 2011. Well, that means that you have to come up with money to buy the buses in 2011. So something's got to disappear. This never says that anything ever disappears. It's just like it's free.
And we will make that statement.
And I think that's
just
what you're looking for. What's going on?
I just want to be clear.
that's a step forward to tell me what you're going to do is defer a purchase from this year to next year. Now, I still have to ask the question, well, why am I doing it this year and not next year anyway? So, you know, if there's really no consequence to that, then it shouldn't have been there in the first place, fine. On the other hand, if it's because we had something saying that if we don't do it by this year, then next year the cost of operating and maintenance goes up by X, or we're going to have this many breakdowns, then I want to know that when I evaluate whether it's a good idea or not to move it from 2010 to 2011.
And then what happens? Ms. Hutchins.
The question that I had raised and that I thought was the concern from the board members was, what would be the impact now of preventive maintenance? And you're saying that the $10 million of stimulus surplus is going to take care of all of that, and there will be no zero, there will be a zero impact as we will see that.
That's correct. On the page, which is on the second page of this docket, it talks about the preventative maintenance funds from the stimulus funds. And this is, I've mentioned this before, but I will repeat it. It's the actual funds that we have in surplus, because some of the contracts that have come in that we had planned under stimulus have come under bid. And as a result, under the guidelines of the FTA, we are allowed to go back to the FDA and to request that we can use these funds eligible for those maintenance of preventive maintenance expenses. That's correct. So it's using one-time funds for preventative maintenance to close the gap here, not the the standard formula funds that we typically receive on a yearly basis. We can make that more clear.
Okay, are there other comments on this issue? Clearly, you're going to get some comments from the board.
That's great.
Before you send this out.
We will not send it out until
we have completed the formal agenda for the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee. I just want to check with the chair.
You can't assign
Mr. Chairman?
Interns.
Mr. Graham, do you want to make a motion now, or do you want to wait until after the committee is completed?
Are you not completed?
We can adjourn this meeting, and you can do a motion of the board.
You should adjourn, and you should
adjourn.
So we are going to adjourn the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee, and we are going to have a momentary meeting of the board.
Yes, I now call to order a special meeting of the Board of Directors for the purposes of considering a motion, which I will now make. I move that the board convene an executive session to discuss personnel matters in accordance with Section Roman numeral 6C of its rules of procedure. Before we vote on this, let me say to the press, most particularly, that I think you will find that there's a very high possibility that we will reconvene on something that is newsworthy for you, and that I would ask that you schedule your availability in a way to be available between the hour of 1 and 2. Convene during, it's hard to predict just precisely when, but we will, I think there's a very high probability that we will reconvene at that time. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
This has been seconded by Mr. Albert. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, we will reconvene here or next door?
We will reconvene in the board.
Over there.
We'll reconvene in the board meeting. And so there being no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The ayes have it. And we now stand in recess.